This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Tonight's guest is Associate Professor Marcus Byrne from the South African Wits University. And it is the first time that we've had an Ig Nobel Prize winner in the studio. Welcome to Dunedin.
Thanks, Samuel. Nice to be here.
Now, you're in Dunedin at the Science Teller Festival, and you're giving two talks, one on dirty dancing, dung beetle, celestial orientation, and another which was called Joe Public Meets the Gibby Gabbies, Using Insects for Public Awareness of Science. And it's got another name, which I'm not even going to try to pronounce.
Yebo Hocha.
That sounded marvellous. Say it again.
Yebo Hocha.
What does that mean?
It's kind of a mixture of languages. Yebo is Zulu for hello, how's it, you know, how's it going? Yes, even. And Hocha is Afrikaans for an insect. So we've just sort of mashed together two words and made the name of a show out of it.
And you didn't grow up in South Africa?
No, I'm a Pommy. So I grew up in the UK, born in Coventry, Irish parents, and then emigrated to South Africa when I was 24.
24, so you'd been to university by then?
Yeah, so that was the reason I went to South Africa. In entomology, we call it mate guarding, where the male of an organism follows a female around and makes sure that no other male gets access to that female. So my girlfriend at the time emigrated to South Africa, and I just couldn't resist, and I was drawn and followed her out there, and we've been married for 28 years. So,
well done.
It paid off. Thanks.
Before that, where did you go to? Where did you do your undergrad degree?
London University, Westfield College, which was delightful. It was, you know, London University had 12 colleges then, and Westfield had 1,000 students, and it was primarily a girls' college until the 60s. So there was a disproportionate number of young ladies in the college, and that's where I started my mate guarding.
And did you do a science degree?
I did. I was a biologist, and like many biologists, I wanted to be a marine biologist, so I bought the diver's watch, and that's about as far as it went. Well, I graduated with a degree in marine zoology.
So it wasn't some obsession as a youngster, an obsession with insects?
No, I was terrified of insects. Being a good Pommy youth, if there was a moth in my bedroom, I'd, "Mom, there's a moth in my room." And so, I mean, it still entertains me to this day that I've got literally buried knee-deep in insects, and I love it, but I was terrified of them as a kid.
So was it accidental that you discovered that they weren't scary and they were fascinating?
Oh, yeah. You know, to give the media its credit, and you guys, I think, do a fabulous job, it was David Attenborough and Jacques Cousteau on the TV that convinced me at a very early age that I wanted to be a biologist. So I knew that. And, of course, I went for the big, dramatic, got to be a marine zoologist, dolphins and whales and whatever. And I ended up in South Africa because of passion rather than for a person rather than an animal. And I was looking for a job. And I ended up at the Australian Dung Beetle Research Unit. I don't know if you've heard of them, that they imported beetles from Africa into Australia to control the dung-breeding flies. So it was a biocontrol program. And that involved going to a game reserve to work on dung beetles. And every evening we sat under this fluorescent lamp eating our dinner. And there were so many insects on the ceiling that you ended up eating a huge proportion of them. And realised that they weren't so bad after all, and the beetles we were working on were just wonderful animals. So I kind of fell into it by accident, yeah, I suppose so. Not the biology, but certainly the insects. Or maybe they fell into my food, and that's why I got into them.
And the dung beetle.
Yeah, that was also a slow awakening and a realisation of what was going on, because I started at the dung beetle research unit, but I actually wasn't working on dung beetles proper. I was working on other insects in dung, because we were trying to control the flies. And there are four groups of beetles that occur in dung, of which dung beetles are only one of them. And the other beetles actually are predators, so they eat the flies. So that's where I started with those guys. But the dung beetles are just such enigmatic animals, and you realise, being around these things, that something going on here, and this is a really cool animal that is hugely entertaining and really interesting.
So you're going to have to give us Beetle 101.
Yeah.
Start at the start. The beetle's got how many legs?
Yeah, okay. It's a classic insect. And in fact, they are the insects of the planet. There are more species of insects on Earth than there are of any other species of organism. So if you put trees, bacteria, fish, mammals, whatever, this is the planet of the beetles. Planet of the insects, and of the insects, the beetles are the most successful of those. So a beetle, you can tell it's an insect is a beetle. It's got six legs, it's got three body parts, and the wings are covered by a set of wing covers. So instead of having two pairs of wings, they've only got obviously one pair, and the other pair is covered by a little set of covers. And that's what probably makes beetles so successful, is because they can do everything. They can walk, they can fly, but they can also bury themselves into the ground because they've got this hard cover on the body, so they can go anywhere. So that's a beetle, and it's a classic holometabolous insect, we call it. It's got full metamorphosis. So it can change its body form completely. So think of a butterfly. It starts off as an egg caterpillar. Caterpillar doesn't look anything like a butterfly, but it's exactly the same individual that just transforms its body from one body form into another. And if you think about it, that's a stunning thing about insects, that they've actually divided labor in the life cycle of one individual. So the caterpillar is an eating machine, and the butterfly is a sex machine. And so the one eats and gets big and fat, and the other one flies off, disperses, and finds a mate within this one life cycle of one individual. And a beetle is the same. It has a larva that doesn't look anything like the adult. It's kind of a wormy thing. Sits inside a dung ball, goes around and around inside the dung ball. And I always say it's a bit like being trapped inside a lunchbox. You're stuffed inside your lunchbox that you must have taken a lunchbox at school, and then you eat your way out of the lunchbox. That's the dung that's around you. And then you transform yourself into a sex machine, and you emerge, you disperse, and you mate.
So the beetles, the adult beetles, aren't eating the dung. It's the dung ball that they're rolling around is to carry the eggs.
It's both. So the larvae eat the dung, and the adults eat the dung as well. But again, it's another interesting research question. We're not actually sure what they're eating. So we know they eat the poo, but which bit of the poo they're eating, we're not positive about. Because if you think about it, there's a food source that's been through somebody else. And so what the devil can you eat out of that?
Is it just that whatever the big animal was is inefficient?
No, we're not sure, because there are fibres in there, so there are grass particles in there, and we're pretty certain that's what the larvae eat, because they've got chewing mouthparts. But the adults can't chew anything, so they've got these little, almost like sieves, that they sieve out tiny, tiny particles out of the liquid portion, and that's how they get the goodness out of it, because those tiny particles are very high in nitrogen. So we know the adults eat the sort of liquids, particulate portion, and then the larvae eat a much drier, fibrous portion. But exactly what they're up to, we're not sure, because, of course, what scientists all over the world are discovering now is that our life is full of bacteria, or life is, in many ways, driven by bacteria. And it may well be that there are symbionts, passengers in the system, that are actually assisting in the breakdown of the food.
So take us through this life cycle. You hatch, or whatever they do to become larva, inside the dung beetle?
Inside the dung ball.
Sorry, inside the dung ball?
Yep. I'll start further back.
Okay.
Because This is why our research is so easy to do, because the beetles are literally obsessed with this material. They are completely enamored with a ball of poo. And they use it for either laying their eggs in, they use it for feeding themselves, or they actually use it as a nuptial gift. So you might buy your girlfriend a box of chocolates or a bunch of roses. Well, a dung beetle will offer his prospective mate a little ball of poo. And if she falls for it, then he'll copulate with her, and then she gets to eat the box of chocolates. So feeding, nuptial gift, and a brood ball. If it's a brood ball, they make a beautiful big ball about the size of a cricket ball. Depends on the species that we're dealing with, because there are actually 800 species of dung beetles in South Africa. And then beetle rolls the ball away, gets buried, and then the egg gets put in the inside of the dung ball. And that's quite a feat in itself, because if I said to you, okay, here's some dung, roll it into a ball, now put an egg right in the middle of it, then...
So they don't roll it around the egg?
No. And the trick is, and it's quite nice to sort of act this out in front of people, but the beetle basically makes a cup and then sits inside the cup and then plonks the egg in the middle of the cup and then seals the top of the cup over. But when you break it open, it looks like this beautiful, almost like an Easter egg. Remember when they used to have sweets inside them? And there's the egg sitting in the middle, like this beautiful...
Just one egg.
Jewel. One egg per ball, always, always, always.
That doesn't seem very efficient.
No, and it, again, reaches into the life cycle of the dung beetle. And again, it depends on the species, but the big individuals have got parental care. So they're like us, that they invest a huge amount in their offspring, and therefore they cannot actually generate that many offspring. So the ones that have parental care, they'll make... one dung ball, maybe three, out of a good session. And then the female will sit with those balls underground for 3 months while the larva develops inside the brood ball. And she communicates with it. So she does what's called stridulating. She rubs her body parts and get this sort of squeaking. And the larva does the same back to her. And it's basically saying, hello, Mum. I'm still here. And she's saying, are you in there, dear? Because it's worth her while to hang around if she knows the larva's alive. And if she hangs around, she increases the probability of the larva surviving, because she can defend the ball against other insects, termites and things like that. She keeps fungus off it. So if you remove her, the probability of the ball going through to an adult is much lower. But she's a caring parent. And you wouldn't really understand it here because of your weather, but we have extremely dry summers. And the beetle basically will stay underground, sorry, dry winters, and the beetle will stay underground during a dry winter and waits for the summer rain. Now, if the summer rain doesn't come, she and the offspring will stay underground till the next year. So they can stay underground for a year with one offspring looking after it. And if she lives for 3 years, she'll generate three offspring in 3 years. It's an incredible production for an insect.
But wouldn't most insects have much more than multiplying it by three?
Oh, yeah. In biology, we describe different life history strategies. And so this is what's called a K-selected strategy, where it's big individuals, massive parental investment, and long life cycle. So that, and that's what humans are. And then the other end of the scale is something like a housefly, and we call those R-selected. Millions of babies, spray them all over the place, no care. They take their chances, and you just bang out the reproductives, as many as possible. So a housefly will produce 300 eggs in your dustbin, and they will fly out and leave it and never come back.
When the larvae does metamorphose into a beetle, is it still in the dung ball at that time, but the parent's gone then?
It depends on the species, but you've described it correctly. So the larva metamorphoses into a pupa. And that effectively is a resting stage. So that can sit for probably a year underground. To be honest, I'm not sure exactly at what point the adult would abandon it. But hopefully it would be at the point then that the rains start. They penetrate through the soil. So you need a good 20 millimeters of rain, a good frog drowner, as my colleague calls it. And it softens the dung ball. The pupa then starts to emerge as it will. The new adult and the old adult, the mother will leave at that point as well.
And even if she had been talking to it all the time as a larva, that's gone, isn't it? Any intelligence that they had gets mushed up. You can't train a larva, and the beetle knows things.
Yeah, really good question. I don't. I'm pretty certain they don't learn. That's almost positive. But can you take something through from a larval stage to an adult? I think in some wasps, it actually is done. That does happen. So wasps tend to learn what a successful host was from the host that they emerged from. Now, we're not sure whether it is a learning process of some sort, or whether they actually just pick up scents from the environment they then emerge in. But I'm positive in this case with the dung beetles, there's no learning that's brought through. And they don't communicate with each other by stridulating either as adults.
So they live as up to 3 years as adults? Is that...
Yeah. So the big ones do. The small guys, like the species that have been introduced here, they will probably only live for 6 months at the most.
And are they social?
No, they're not. Actually, not at all. Is the easiest way to describe it. I think the only time they get together is for sex, and then and the only other social behaviour is the parental care of the mother. And there are a few species, I think, that the male hangs around for a while, but not that long.
Is that because they don't like each other, or is there some evolutionary benefit of being solitary?
It's almost not an emotional issue, it will be an evolutionary driven decision, in that particularly for males it's fairly obvious that all you've got to do is ensure paternity, and as long as you hang around long enough doing your mate guarding to make sure that no other male gets in and fertilizes the female that you've just fertilized before she produces an egg, then you're fairly certain that egg was yours, and at that point you can abandon the system. Now, the reasons that humans don't normally do that is because by the male hanging around, he increases the probability of that offspring being reared to sexual maturity itself. But with the dung beetle, the package is already there, because it's the lunchbox, the brood ball that's made. And once that's in place, you don't really need two guardians, because he's not going to forage.
So what do the males do all the rest of the time? Are they out there practicing building giant dung balls?
Well, that's a really good question, because, and no one's ever looked at it, but we are fairly certain, just from watching these things in the field, and we watch them, you know, ad nauseum, I would guess that a big dung ball is a bit like having a Porsche, that the other guys are pretty impressed, and the girls seem to go for the big dung ball as well. But they don't practice. Now, finding dung seems to be fairly easy for them, but making a dung ball is a fair bit of work. And you hang around the bar, which is the big pile of poo, with your big dung ball, and hopefully pick up a chick there and roll it away with her. But you've got to fight off the other males. And that's probably what they spend their life doing, is finding poo and beating up other guys.
So are some of them good at it? Do some sad dung beetles produce sort of lopsided small ones?
Brilliant question, and you're absolutely right. And it comes down to size, because what dictates size in a dung beetle's life is not the genetic lineage. You don't inherit your size from your parents. You inherit it, or you get it, from the size of the lunchbox. So depending on how much food mum and dad have packed into the lunchbox will dictate your eventual body size. And a big male is good at fighting. So... he will win most of the contests and will be able to make a big dung ball. So the little sad guys, interestingly, make a trade-off. And they make a trade-off during that life cycle development. So when they go into pupation and metamorphose, they invest less in body armor and weight and structures. A lot of males have ornaments on their head. The little guys don't invest in those. Instead, they invest in their genitalia. So a small male dung beetle, again depends on the species, for his body size will have a very large pair of testes. And the trade-off there is, okay, I'm not going to win many fights, I'm probably not going to get too many girlfriends, but when I do, I'm going to transfer as much sperm into that individual as I can to increase my chances of fertilizing her and parenting an offspring. So life is, even for a dung beetle, it's full of trade-offs at the bar and in the restaurant and in the workplace.
And you know this because you go, you sit out, do you sit or is it kneeling? How do you watch these things? Do you sit beside a pile of poo and wait?
It's one of the things I always advocate. If you get the chance to go to Africa and you've done all the big stuff and whatever, you know, seen the elephants and the lions and stuff, on a day where it's nice and hot, it's rained the day before, it's in summer, you find a pile of poo. If you can't find one, you can always make one. You get a beer, you sit down, and you wait for the beetles to come in. And they are just something else. They're so entertaining. So it is, yeah, it's from observation largely. And that's what triggers questions. It's that sitting and thinking and just absorbing the wildlife that's going on around you. And then obviously on top of that, then you have to do experiments, which that's okay, but it's the repetition and the trying to establish what you think is going on, it really is going on.
So when someone opens up a new bar, so to speak, a pile of poo appears in the field. How far away do the beetles come from?
We're not sure. Another question that's sitting out there, literally it's like most fields of science, that as you dig into it, you actually turn up more questions than answers, and that's the joy of science in many respects. So the short answer is we think probably about 10 k's away.
Wow.
Yeah. And the big guys basically cruise, and they go at a cruise flight at about 3 meters above the ground, and you can see them whipping over the bush. And then as soon as they pick up the smell, they drop down to about a meter, and then they quarter up the breeze towards the poo, and usually cut motors about a meter away, drop onto the ground, and then sort of toddle in with antennae bristling and looking as if they're about to have a good time. And it literally can happen in seconds, from the dung being dropped to the beetles arriving, to the point where some people honestly think, I didn't eat that. And the beetles arrive. They're there. They're incredible animals.
And do they communicate? Do they spot that each other have found one? I'm thinking of seagulls. You throw some chips out to a seagull and one starts squawking and the rest appear. If only that seagull would be quiet, get some minutes for that.
Yeah, vultures do the same as well. They keep an eye on each other in the upper atmosphere. No, I'm pretty certain they don't, because they are so competitive once they get to the dung. I'm sure they don't, because their eyesight is not sharp enough to keep an eye on each other, and their brain's not big enough either to keep an eye on each other of who's around you. I'm sure their principal visual problem when they're flying is not to bump into things.
So do they have an established nest, or do they get the dung ball and take it to somewhere and create a nest?
Again, depends on the species. The bulk of species, it's a one-way trip. So arrive at the dung, grab a piece, and there are two principal handling techniques there. The majority of beetles actually just go straight underground, zook, and they disappear. And they shuttle back and forth between the soil surface or the dung and the nest that they make underground. Only 10% of dung beetles actually roll a ball.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Yeah, well, in some ways it's quite nice. Those are the elite. And they grab a piece. Again, depends on the species. And it's a bit like, you know, being at a buffet, and you get a big plate full and you want to head away to make sure that nobody else is going to interfere with your feeding, and you run off in a straight line. And so that for most of them is literally a one-way trip. Grab some of the dung and then head off. Now, of course, evolution being what it is and the joy of biology and nature, that there are a couple of species that they do actually provision. So they'll grab a big piece of dung, take it away, and then bury that into a nest, a hole in the ground, and then do a return journey. And they'll repeat that back and forth. So they actually will provision a nest. And, of course, for us as biologists, that's great, because now you've got another set of questions to ask. Not only how do you get away in a straight line, but also
how do you get back?
How the devil do you find your way back?
Do they follow the trail that they left on the way out, or is it?
Good. No, they don't. And we had thought that the smell might be one of the orientation cues that they use. No, they use the same system that they used on the way out. So they use what we call celestial cues. So the sun and patterns of light in the sky, and then the nocturnal species use the stars and the moon. So they've got a very simple brain, so they can't really remember landmarks, although some insects do, and we can maybe discuss that if you want to explore that idea. But we know that they do two things when they find food. They need to know where their house is in terms of a bearing, so which direction it's in, and they need to know what the distance is. And we know from other insects, and we think this is going to be the case with dung beetles, is that on the way out they count their steps, and then on the and they know that what angle they are to the sun, for instance. And then when they head back, all they need to do is re-establish that angle and then literally count the steps home. And that's how they find their way home.
So, a couple of questions in there. I'm sure there's lots of questions, but here's my two questions. A, the sun's moved.
Yep.
And B, if you trick them into going on a little deviation, do they counter for it?
Okay, first question. The movement of the sun is, I think it's... should get this right. I can't remember now. I think it's about 4 degrees a minute. So it's actually relatively slow over the distances and the times that they operate. So the movement of the sun is not that important. We know bees can deal with that, and that's time in the nest and things like that. And when they can't see the sun, we're pretty certain the dung beetles don't have a clock, and we don't think they need it. So that's how they deal with the movement of the sun. Sorry, I've forgotten your other question then.
If you move them on the way back, or you make them go around a barrier, will they go around that barrier even if it's not there?
Yep, and that is a classic experiment that these guys cannot cope with. That if you displace them at the food source, so you move them a meter to one side of where they found the food, and you basically slide them on a piece of paper or something like that. When they return home, they will be displaced by a meter when they return to their home place.
So they'll go off at the right angle, but miss.
Absolutely.
And do they know? Do they think, hang on, I've been going here for a while. What do they do then?
When they get the right distance away, when they've counted the steps home, then they start doing a square search to look for home. But they are completely lost because they cannot regenerate any information about where home was. Now, that's really fascinating as an entomologist, because things like ants and bees and wasps do the same, but they use landmarks as well around the house. So if they get lost returning home, they have a memory of certain landmarks, whereas we've shown with the dung beetles, they seem to have dropped the ability to use landmarks. And we think that's because the basal character is the grab the food, run away individual. So he never needs a landmark because he's never in a familiar place. It's always a new place. So why on earth waste any brain power trying to remember where the house is and the shops are and the clinic and the bus stop? Everything's new every time. So they've dropped the ability to use landmarks. Now, we think the provisioners have evolved from the grab-it-and-go guys. And unfortunately, evolution has taken away the landmark ability, if it was ever there. And so our provisioners, when they come back and we've displaced them, they're lost because they don't have any landmarks in their little brains to say, I should have been left of that bush instead of right. And that fiendish entomologist has pulled me over here and I'll eventually work my way back home. They're gone.
Well, doing things like discovering or working out things like how they follow the sun, you're doing experiments by carrying umbrellas above them and that sort of thing. Do you sit in the lab and think up these things to do to them?
Okay, so you should go into the field with us because you've obviously got the right sort of fiendish brain for these sorts of experiments. And that's basically what we do, is that they're very simple experiments. You've got a simple animal and you're asking it a simple question. Yes or no, are you using the sun? And if you set up the right experiment, you get a straightforward answer, yes or no. And everybody's happy and the beetle goes on its merry way. And that's exactly what we do, is the sun experiment is a classic 100-year-old experiment. Put a brolly or a board over it so it can't see the sun. Reflect the sun from a new position, usually 180 degrees, because that's the easiest, so you stand on the opposite side. And hey presto, the beetle turns 180 degrees and heads off in the new direction. And the answer is, to the question, are you using the sun? And the answer is absolutely yes.
So they will go off in the wrong direction?
Yep. And we love it. Because, you know, the satisfaction of a correct result, and if you can repeat it over and over and over again to get the statistical significance of, yes, this is not just chance, then what a pleasure.
Why do we need to know?
Good question. I think there's two reasons. And I think the first reason is because we're curious. And I honestly believe that that is the principal issue behind this. And it sounds very arrogant and very self-indulged, but I think that a society that allows people to be curious and ask crazy blue sky questions is a wonderful society to live in. And it's part of the human condition that why is the sky blue? Why is grass green? And I think those are very, very important questions to answer. And if we didn't have that human behavior of curiosity and creativity, then we wouldn't have a lot of poetry. There'd be a lot of music that wouldn't occur, wouldn't exist, and literature. And I don't think things have to have a purpose in themselves, because ultimately those things we can sell, you know, one way or another. And I really believe that science shouldn't have to be commercial at its basis. Then the other reason is that we can actually learn things from these guys, because they've got tiny little brains. Now, our brain is several billion cells. The human brain has been described as the most complicated thing that we know of in the universe, because it clearly is. It's an incredible device. An insect brain has got about 300,000 neurons in it, so it's really a cut-down racing version. This thing is running on minimal megabytes. And now it solves what would appear to be a fairly complex problem. How am I going to go in a straight line? How am I going to find my way home? With this minimal computing power, it can't build a mental map of the landmarks around it. It just hasn't got the brains to do it. But with very, very little neurons, it can actually solve that problem. Now, if you can build that into a computer circuit, you've got a device that can find its way around autonomously, again, with minimal energy and minimal computing power.
When you won the Ig Nobel Prize, I'll come back to that in a minute, but the picture that was circulated was the dung beetles wearing socks,
oh, yes,
or little boots. Yeah. What was that about?
That was a great experiment, because, again, it was one of these ones of you work with the beetles, you're working with them, and you do it over and over again, and suddenly, it gradually seeps into your brain that there's something going on that you haven't spotted and you haven't been aware of. And what it was we were working in 35 degrees, thinking, oh, I'm hot. And then you look at the beetles and you think, he looks hot too. And he's not doing what he used to do. In fact, they changed their behavior. And, of course, we were interested in the orientation behavior, which, as we've discussed, is this ball rolling business. But a key part of the ball rolling behavior is the orientation dance. And every now and then the beetle stops, gets on top of his little ball, and does a 360, basically revolves around its own body axis. And we know it's looking at the sky, because if we put a hat on it, then it gets lost. And we realized that when we were hot and the beetles looked hot, they were dancing more often. They were climbing on top of the ball. And we thought, it's either got to be the sun. There's something different about the sun. It's upsetting their orientation device, their behavior. Or they're trying to get off the hot ground. And that's what we worked out, was that they were using the dung ball as a thermal refuge. So you get onto a hot beach, which is difficult to imagine in Otago.
It's not that difficult.
Sorry. And, you know, you burn your feet on the sand, then you throw your towel down and you stand on the sand. Or you jump on somebody else's towel and you think, hot feet. And that's your thermal refuge. Now, we know that other insects do this. So ants do it, for instance. It's called stilting. And they hurtle along and then they go up a piece of grass and they hang on to the piece of grass for 30 seconds and then they get back down on the ground again and then they hurtle to the next one. These were the first animals that we showed were using a mobile thermal refuge, this dung ball, which they were pushing along. And this is a beautiful example of evolution where they've got this structure which has one purpose, making babies, getting girlfriends, or eating itself, so it's food. And now suddenly it turns into a thermal refuge. And so what they do is they get very hot, roll the ball along, jump on top, cool down a bit, take a little bit of the ice cream, because it's mainly liquid, the dung ball, cool down, and then they head off again. So what we thought was that the front legs were mediating this heat response. So we gave them these sorts of oven gloves or little booties made out of silicon, and then repeated the experiments to see if they danced more or less often when we insulated their feet. guess what? When we put oven gloves on their front feet, then they dance less often.
Because they weren't getting hot on the walking across the ground.
Yeah, so the boots insulated their feet.
So tell me about the process of winning this Ig Nobel Prize.
Yeah, it was good. It's an interesting thing, and I can talk forever on this, I'm afraid. I'd known about it for a long time, and it's kind of a backhanded compliment to one's research, because there's two things that make you aware of that. The first is that they phone you up and discreetly offer you the award and say, are you going to accept it? And if you don't, if you wish to refuse the award, then that's the end of the story. And the other thing is the tagline that goes with the award is science that makes you think, makes you laugh and makes you think. So there have been some pretty bizarre things that have won in the past. And we debated whether we would go for it or not. And I'm really delighted we did, because it's taught me a lot about bringing science to the general public. And actually, I now understand the value of that prize.
In attracting attention to the research?
That itself, yes, you're absolutely right. The publicity that came from that was incredible. Literally, millions and millions of people were exposed to that. And we've had press coverage all over the world. We've had all sorts of news coverage. So for ourselves, that was good. But the principal issue with the award is bringing science to the general public. And I think that's why it fits in so well with the science teller story that we're going through this week. And the guy that runs is a guy called Mark Abrams, who's very low-key, and to the extent where I said to him, are you making money out of this? And he said, no, not really. And I said, but you could. He said, I'm not interested. What he wants to do is to show people that science can be fun. And I think that's an important thing. But I think the other thing that he's getting across, and he doesn't let any of this out, so he's not creating a manifesto that people then apply to it. But I think the other thing that he's showing is that science is not a creed, and that science can be bent, folded, stapled, beat up in any way you like, and it still works. It's this self-correcting system that doesn't need respect, but it's a very valuable system for explaining the world around us. And that's the thing with the Ig Nobel. There is no respect. There's no nodding and bowing and scraping in the whole thing at all. You know, there are four Nobel Prize winners sitting on the stage when you get your prize. And one of them is sweeping up the paper airplanes that the audience has thrown at them and at us at the same time. It's completely irreverent, but it's great. It's exactly the right way to do this.
Is there a speech at the ceremony?
There is, yes. Each of the awardees, and there are 10 every year, gets a minute to give a speech of some sort. Now, if you start saying thank you, that you'll get interrupted straight away. If you go over a minute, you'll get interrupted. And the way you get interrupted is by a small girl coming up to you, an 8-year-old, saying, please stop, I'm bored. Please stop, I'm bored. So again, completely irreverent. But we practiced our speech, and we again try to make a point. And what we did is we said that some people think science is crap, and some people think our science is crap. But we said we use crap as a vehicle of discovery, and, you know, referring to our work on dung. And it seemed to go down really well, and we finished off by saying, because we were carrying these huge balls, these sort of exercise balls, and we basically said, you know, to do good science, you've got to have balls, and threw our balls into the audience, and of course they loved it. So that was the official speech. And then 2 days later, we spoke at MIT, which was, well, this is great. Now you get 5 minutes to do a speech there. But again, completely irreverent. Mark gets somebody from the audience to time you. He gets somebody else from the audience to make a noise. And every minute of your 5 minutes, the timer sticks his hand up and the noisemaker makes a noise. And you've got literally 5 minutes to get your science across. And again, it really worked, and it was an amazing experience.
It seems to me that you'd be somebody who is used to engaging people in the science, the process of science. You can imagine that some people might be a little bit more serious and don't take on that education role, not just for their own students, but the wider society, which I think you're clearly using the opportunity to talk about the dung beetles as a way of engaging people in hypothesis testing and things.
Yeah, thanks. Well, that's a nice compliment. That's how I'd like to see myself. And I'm really lucky that I've worked with some fantastic people who are the same. And I think we owe it to the public because, as I said, you know, I live in a society that allows me to do these crazy things. And it's my job to actually give back, one, the knowledge, and it's very specific knowledge, but people love dung beetle stories. But two, as you said, it's the process. One is the process, how do you do it? And the other is actually also the product. And I think, you know, you give me the opportunity to say my little speech about blue sky science. It's also important that, if, you know, I considered a dinner table in Johannesburg with some, you know, pretty powerful people that, you know, have proper jobs, and they say, and where have you been? Oh, I've been to New Zealand. What were you doing? Oh, I was talking about dung beetles. And you think, what's going on here? And there's two ways you can play it, because some people always ask the question, what value is it? And I think it's always worth throwing in the first one, even if you're getting under somebody's skin, to say it doesn't have a value, and see if the party breaks up at that point. Or then we get into a discussion about the value of blue sky science.
Because it does have value. It is biological control. If we were insisting on looking at it from that perspective, you can. There is reasons for doing this. You said you first worked for the Australian dung beetle because they were looking at it as biological control.
Absolutely.
What was it controlling?
Dung breeding flies. You know, the good old Aussie hat with the corks on and the g'day, you know. Mm. He sweeps the flies away from in front of his face. And so, again, you know, humans have altered the ecosystem, brought in cattle with a completely new food source for flies, brought at least one species of fly in with them, think two. They went berserk in the cow dung. Also, the bush was cleared to create pasture for the cows. And so this altered environment needed new organisms in it to shift away the dung, and that's where we started. But in fact, you can go back even further. Dung beetles are the ultimate recyclers, and what they're doing is returning nutrients into the soil. They aerate the soil, they're putting nitrogen back into it. And so that dung beetle program did two really important things. One was turning over the pastures, and the other was competing with the flies for the dung source, because the dung beetles are very, very good competitors.
And cute to watch.
Oh, yeah.
Are they endangered? 800 species, you'd think some of them would be stuck in a corner somewhere.
Yeah, unfortunately they are. And whether they're endangered or just extremely rare, we don't know. There's one species that is a very large flightless species that occurs on the east coast of South Africa, and it's called the Addo elephant dung beetle. And it doesn't fly, so already it's at a massive disadvantage. If you think looking for dung, patchy, ephemeral, it's there for 2 days, then it's useless because it's dried out. The elephants in the meantime have walked 30 kilometres. So it's a really bizarre lifestyle. And it was thought to be very restricted, and in fact it is. It used to have a much broader range, and it now occurs in little patches where there are game reserves, but also on farms. So that one is considered to be rare, but there are these other forest species. It's like your guys here, the dung beetles here, little forest patches. And there's one species I know of that has only been collected from middens, so toilet latrines of a thing called a dassy. It's a rock hyrax. It's like a big sort of ratty thing. And it's been collected from dead specimens that have been found in these ones on the west coast in these very, very remote dried riverbeds. And as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been a single live specimen collected. And there's about half a dozen dead ones rooted out of a dassy latrine. So some of them are extremely rare.
Is it difficult to get public funding, public sympathy for saving a beetle?
I don't think so. Well, I think the first step is awareness. As far as I know, nobody has funded anything for the Addo elephant dung beetle. But most South Africans do know about it. So, for instance, the game park that they're in has road signs that say Beware of the Dung Beetle. So it's the classic red triangle with a white background and the beetle rolling a ball across. And it's to stop people driving through the poo that's on the road, because that's, you know, whoa, splash through, get it all over your Land Rover, look as if you've been in the bush. And, of course, it's full of dung beetles, so you squish the whole lot of them as you go through. So, and people respond. They love it. And South Africans love their dung beetles in a way. I suspect you guys love your wetters, because I was asking my host what the response to a wetter is here, because we've got a similar one in Johannesburg. We call it the Parktown Prawn, and it's regarded with utter horror. People are terrified of the things. But apparently here you guys quite like wetters.
I think so. I think the fact that it's native is recognised. We know it's not dangerous. That helps.
Yeah.
We look in horror at whatever it is that they've got in Australia, and yeah, we know ours are kind of all right.
Sweet and yeah, well, which is great, and I see. There you go. I think that's a really nice point. That there you've got an insect. Poof. You know, who likes insects? But there is a level of awareness in the public, and that awareness is sympathetic rather than terrified. And that whoever has driven that has done a great job.
I want to talk about I'm going to have to pronounce it, aren't I? Yebo Gogga. You had it much better than that. You say it again.
Yebo Gogga.
Yes, that. So what's that?
Yeah, that's an insect show, and that started many years ago now. That must be nearly 15 years ago. And it was an attempt by the university, in association with Johannesburg Zoo, to do exactly what we've been talking about, is to say to people, insects are all around us, insects are really cool, and they're an important part of our ecosystem. So let's bring them into some sort of situation where we can literally stuff them under your nose and say, look at this. And it's quite a hard thing to do, because a zoo is easy. You know, a lion pacing in a cage is not a great thing to see. But nevertheless, the animal's there, and it's dramatic. So Yebo Gogga was an interesting departure, because you can't put an insect in a cage. You can put it in a glass tank, and it'll just sit there, and it's not very exciting. But if you can pick it out, put it in the hand of the person you're talking to, and say, look at this. Isn't this cool? Watch what it's doing. Look at its eyes. Look at its antennae. Look at its legs. Watch, it's going to do this. No, it won't bite you. Why is it? Look at the colours of it. This thing can see in 5 colours. You can only see in 3 colours. Immediately, you can engage the person you're talking to. The problem is it's a labour-intensive type of engagement, but it's great fun.
But you have enormous numbers.
Yeah, we do. It runs for about 4 or 5 days once a year, and we get at least 5,000 visitors through in those 5 days. So we get about at least 1,000. So we've had some incredible numbers. When we were at the zoo, we were pushing up over 10,000, and we would run it for a week. But people are interested, and the schools are great. They support us, and people come back year after year.
Given that only a small percentage of people are going to go on and actually be scientists, and a much smaller percentage are going to go on and be zoologists, and even tinier percentage of that are going to be entomologists, what are you hoping to get out of that? It's not just a careers thing, is it?
No. And again, I think that's an important point to raise, in that the danger with our education system at the moment, and when I say we, I mean Western education, is that are we trying to clone ourselves? That's always the danger, that you as a teacher or as a lecturer are trying to generate another one of you. And society is different. You know, we know now that education systems have been built for the Victorians, really. And at the top of the system were the engineers and the mathematicians and the doctors. And then down at the bottom of the system are the artists and the dancers and the painters. And they don't have the same credibility and status. And I think we have to overturn that. We have to throw that out, rework that idea. And I think what we're trying to do now is basically say to Joe Public, this is the world around you. We're in it, and we need to know about it, because we're utterly dependent on it. And if we can demystify any part of it, including insects in the garden or insects in your bed or wetters in your bathroom, then that's an important thing that that we can do.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Wow. No, but now that you've said it, I actually quite like the idea. You know, if listening to me droning on about dung beetles, well, then maybe, yeah, I'll go for that. Thanks.
And what are the challenges for the next couple of years?
The dung beetles are easy because they just keep throwing up stuff. Literally this week we've brought out a paper that we showed there's a species that gallop. And that is radical because all insects walk in a particular way. And insects are the most common organism on the planet. And we've now found one that gallops. So the dung beetles are there. I think if I'm going to call myself an activist, the advocacy, I think, is to keep on hooking the two things together. Get the crazy stories. These beetles use the Milky Way. This beetle gallops. And just keep up the energy to keep talking to guys like you, because you're the vehicle that we're using to get to the general public and say, oh, look at this stuff. It's fascinating. So I suppose it's maintaining relationships with folk like you that is the challenge.
Well, thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who wasn't here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. Tonight's guest was Associate Professor Marcus Byrne from South African Wits University. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. Follow the links there to find us on Facebook, and you can listen to find us on iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
Sustainable Lens on radio.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.